Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. So what happens when an economist who's married to an economist and is the daughter of two economists gets pregnant? She gets obsessed with the statistics, of course. She is Emily Oster, economics professor at the University of Chicago, and frustrated by the one-size-fits-all directives from doctors about what pregnant women should and should not eat, drink, and do, she decided to wade through the research and the data so you don't have to. And what she found was the conventional wisdom, like that you should not drink alcohol or coffee, is often wrong. The book is called Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know. Welcome to WNYC, Emily Oster.
Thank you so much for having me.
And pregnant women out there, recently pregnant women or prospective pregnant women, call us up and ask questions. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I should say Emily is not a doctor. She's an economist, so don't think you're getting advice from a medical professional, but she has looked at research and data and can tell you what she has found out from fertility issues all the way to delivery. And doctors, feel free to call too. Many of Emily Oster's findings are controversial, so we'll leave some lines open if people want to challenge. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's get right down to some of the surprising and controversial things you conclude in your book, like a few cups of coffee a day is fine, one alcoholic drink a day in the second and third trimesters is fine, sushi is fine. Those fly in the face of the most common advice. So start with coffee, because that was your most immediate concern, right?
Yeah, it was. So when I got pregnant, I think like a lot of women, I was like, okay, I'm used to having a couple of cups of coffee a day. You know, is this something that I have to cut out? And so I think in the case of coffee, I think everybody kind of agrees that in some moderation, it's okay. So actually, that's something where I am very much in line with what the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says, up to 200 milligrams a day. I actually go through in the book and I argue that much of the evidence would suggest that even if you want to have a bit more than that, that many women would feel comfortable with that, especially in later trimesters. I think it's a good example. Coffee is a good example of in the book of kind of really going through the evidence and showing people, why might you think just 200 milligrams is okay? Why might you feel comfortable with more than that? And suggesting that people may want to think about that choice for themselves, which is really all that the data is doing. It's kind of helping people go through these decisions on their own with the facts rather than taking, some rule without any defense.
Yeah. What do you mean by 200 milligrams when you're talking about coffee?
So 200 milligrams actually depends where you get your coffee from. So a typical 8-ounce cup, that you make at home would probably have something like 100 milligrams, although actually Starbucks has a bit more than that. And I have a little, primer in the book about kind of a few different places and what the coffee looks like.
Of caffeine or of the coffee itself, 100
of
milligrams?
Caffeine. Of caffeine. Yeah. Of caffeine.
And so what kind of study? Give our listeners an example. Like if you're concluding there's a safe level and there's an unsafe level, is it because there have been studies of birth defects in women who've drank more coffee or less coffee?
No. So the concern in coffee, especially in the first trimester, is that it might increase the risk of miscarriage. So studies that look at this, what they do is they compare women who drink different amounts of coffee and they look at whether they miscarry. And there's basically two problems. So one or two challenges. One is that the kind of women who drink a lot of coffee are different in some important ways before pregnancy than women who don't. They tend to be older. And age in particular is also linked with miscarriage risk. And so you have to be careful to adjust for that. In addition, there's a much more basic problem, which is that nausea is a very good sign about a healthy pregnancy, and women who are nauseous tend to avoid coffee. So it's actually very hard to ferret out the impact of coffee as separate from the impact of nausea. And so it may be that the fact that we see any link between coffee and miscarriage is only because nauseous women tend to avoid coffee, and then it looks like it's the coffee, but really it's not. So I think mm-hmm. that's something that, I talk about some in the book, and I think is actually, it's a big challenge for this kind of, for this particular issue.
So nausea as a confounding variable in the
exactly.
data. Let's move from
exactly.
coffee to alcohol. The directive from the medical establishment about alcohol that you should not have any seems like it was for you the fundamental frustrating thing about all this advice for pregnant women. You found that the research shows that a drink a day in the second and third trimesters is perfectly fine, but the doctors won't say it's fine because they think if they say one glass is okay, women will drink three. Is that where you're coming from?
That's one thing. I think a first thing to say is actually there's a fair amount of disagreement about this. So, for example, there's a 2010 survey that I've talked about, some not in the book but elsewhere, which shows like 40% of doctors think that some alcohol in pregnancy is okay. And I think that many women get advice from their doctor, which is sort of like, well, a couple of drinks is fine in the later trimesters. And that's certainly the advice I got. For me, faced with the idea that there's some disagreement, books say one thing, doctors disagree with each other. I think all I could really do in that case is say, okay, look, if this were my job, the way that I would approach this is to figure out what the data says. So it's very clear that drinking to excess is problematic. I think everyone agrees on that. In fact, even an occasional binge drinking episode can be very dangerous. But really, the kinds of studies we want to look at to answer the question, could I have a glass of wine, three times a week, are studies which look at women who drink at that level, who do not binge drink, who have, one small 4-ounce glass of wine 3 times a week. And for those kind of data, you actually mostly need to go to Europe, because that kind of level of drinking is much more common. And when you look at that data, what you see is that women who drink at those levels, and in these studies they sort of tend to include women who have up to a drink a day, those women have children whose outcomes look just like the children of women who abstain. Mm. And so when I go through that evidence, I suggest, I think that is probably why there is so much disagreement about this. And I think, for some women, they may look at that and decide that, they feel comfortable having an occasional glass of wine.
So you're right. Drink like a European adult, not like a fraternity brother.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a case in which moderation is incredibly important. Understanding what one, that one drink means 12 ounces of beer or 4 ounces of wine, something which I think women are tremendously capable of understanding. Those are important things to recognize. But, it's a little, I think that there's room for kind of
right.
nuance and discussion.
When
here.
You say these are things that women are capable of understanding, do you think that the medical establishment shows a distrustful and patronizing attitude toward pregnant women, thinking they're not going to be able to understand the nuances in the data, so we're just going to say don't do it?
I think a much larger issue is that our time with doctors is very limited, and I think explaining the nuance in these things actually is not something that can happen in a 10-minute visit, once a month, when also you need to be getting all sorts of other things done. So I think that a much larger issue than any kind of how people feel about what women can understand is just that there isn't time to do that, and I think that's what women often hope to get out of books, which they are able to read and have, more time with. And that's something I found lacking in many of the existing books, which is ultimately where this came from.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio, and my guest is Emily Oster, University of Chicago economics professor, who has written Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know. Questions? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Bob in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Brian. How you doing, guy?
All right.
My question is this. I once met a doctor. He specifically said that he worked in Japan. There's a huge incidence of stomach cancer because of raw sushi. Now, the young lady is recommending it's okay, raw sushi. A child has low immunity. Could be very seriously dangerous. I was wondering if she really has absolute research to make that statement.
All right. Let's do the sushi thing, Emily.
Sure. So the concern with sushi in pregnancy is actually not about links with stomach cancer, but just that, like many kinds of foods, the idea is that it can cause foodborne illness. In fact, you know, although that is always a risk of sushi, it doesn't get any worse when you are pregnant. There's no extra reason to avoid this during pregnancy, although, of course, it's always a good idea to make sure your sushi is from a reputable source and so on. I think one thing to say that is definitely right that we recommend to women in pregnancy is to avoid high mercury fish in sushi, so tuna, swordfish, things which have a lot of mercury. Those affect fetal brain development. So if you're going to have sushi, kind of keep to salmon.
But that would be the same recommendation for cooked fish, right? If you're talking about high mercury level fish, tuna and other things, then it doesn't matter whether it's raw or cooked. Would that be accurate?
No, that's definitely right. So in general, when you think about fish, there's kind of a desire to avoid things that have a lot of mercury, whether or not you cook them.
And if you're more likely to get sick, even just to throw up after eating raw fish, I mean, couldn't that be a threat to the baby?
So it is potentially more unpleasant to have a stomach flu while you are pregnant. Salmonella, unlike some of these other foodborne illnesses like toxoplasmosis or listeria, doesn't pass through to the baby. So I think that's the sense in which it's kind of the risk is similar.
And also on food restrictions, some of them you agree with, the things that people usually hear, like raw milk, cheese should be avoided, deli meats in general should be avoided?
Yeah, so I think raw milk, cheese for sure. So the concern with both the deli meats and the raw milk, cheese is that they carry a risk for listeria. And what's very clear is that listeria is terrible and you would like to avoid it, you know, as much as possible. The thing that makes that very hard is that it's actually very hard to predict where listeria will come up. So a lot of the recent large outbreaks were in things like cantaloupe or celery, which are kind of totally unpredictable, and nobody is recommending that women avoid those. Raw milk, soft cheese is a relatively common cause of listeria, and so I think, you know, prudence would argue for avoiding that. Deli turkey is also somewhat common, although actually other deli meats aren't really. And so I think some women, and this is true for me, may decide, like, if you want to have a ham sandwich, you know, that may be okay.
David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, David.
Hi, Dr. David. Question, what about smoking cigarettes before pregnancy? I'm wondering why. I'm a physician. I'm wondering why that's not a warning on cigarette labels, since baby uses mommy lungs, and smoking 10 years before pregnancy has, you know, negative outcomes with the birth.
Huh. Did you look into anything like that?
So I think one thing that's very clear is smoking during pregnancy, smoking is really bad. I think, you know, I actually didn't look much at the question of smoking before pregnancy, although I could easily, you know, what David said sounds exactly plausible to me, that it would be problematic. I mean, I think in general, you know, we're doing a lot to encourage people to quit smoking. We should be doing more of that for pregnant people, for non-pregnant people, for sure.
So we stop and pause for a second to say that conventional wisdom is right on smoking cigarettes.
Definitely.
Here's a different smoking question from Mike in Hillsborough. Mike, you're on WNYC.
Hi, good morning. I was just curious if you've ever heard of Melanie Dreyer. She actually works out of the University of Iowa as, like, the assistant dean. And she's actually gone down to Jamaica and has seen the effects of marijuana or cannabis use during pregnancy to actually help combat nausea. So, you know, on one token, you know, the woman's unable to keep food down, which is harmful for the baby. But on the other token, you know, by ingesting that, were there any negative effects? And the study actually shows that there weren't.
All right. Well, it's a good question, because one of the uses of medical marijuana is to combat nausea. Did you look into this at all and the nausea that people experience during pregnancy?
So I tried actually to look at marijuana, and I was interested not actually in the question of treatment for nausea, but just in whether there is evidence that this is risky. It's actually very hard to do that with data that we have, because the kind of people who smoke marijuana tend to be very different than those who don't. And also, because it's illegal, it's very hard to get people to report accurately. So there just isn't really any good evidence on that. I think, you know, in general, the point that, like, having very serious nausea can be problematic and that women often are reluctant to seek treatment for that, I think is totally right. And actually, we do have good treatments that are not marijuana for nausea. So I think, you know, for women who are feeling nauseous, I sort of go through some of this in the book, like how much is normal. But I think women are often a little bit too nervous about asking their doctor for some kind of drug treatment when actually we have a number of drugs which are really good, which don't appear to pose any risk for the baby.
Emily Oster, University of Chicago economist, author of Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know. And she looked at a lot of data from a lot of studies having to do with the actual health risks to mother or child during pregnancy, and concludes that many times doctors are being just too cautious in what they tell women that they can or can't do. So we're going through some of the details. Here's a question on our comments page. I think you get into this in the book. Sarah on our comments page asks, what about dyeing your hair, like single process, highlights, et cetera?
Yeah, it's fine. So there was some concern about hair dye either causing cancer, which I think turned out just not to be true, and also causing premature birth. That second fact was from a study of women who were hairdressers, and I think ultimately it was concluded that that was mostly because their job involved standing up all day, not because of the hair dye. So I think the general guideline of hair dye is fine is, in fact, true.
Pregnant women shouldn't work at jobs where they stand up all day?
No, it's just that is also not really true. It's I think that there is some weaker evidence that maybe that could be linked to preterm birth, and that is probably what was going on in that particular study.
But you do say pregnant women should be cautious about gardening.
I do, yeah. So actually, this came up when I started researching the question of whether it's okay to change the cat's litter box. And the reason you might not want to do that is because of a parasite called toxoplasmosis, which could cause birth defects. In fact, there isn't a lot of evidence that cleaning the litter box is linked to that, largely because most people's cats don't live outside and eat raw meat. But in fact, that is pretty heavily linked to gardening. So to the extent you were going to avoid one of those activities, you'd be better off avoiding gardening, which has been shown to increase the toxoplasmosis risk.
Wow. You just shocked a lot of people out there with that one, I have a feeling, because they would think, what's going to be purer for the, you know, mother and child soul than gardening?
Right. The problem is that cats are pooping in your garden. That's the basic issue.
Getting right down to the science there.
Exactly. Right down to the cat's poop in your garden.
Straight
and so that's what it is.
From Emily Oster. Marianne in Croton-on-Hudson, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you that I lived overseas for 12 years in Asia and Africa, and women, of course, do a lot of different things. It actually confirms some of the things you're saying about cheese and chocolate, and I think that we generally have a pretty anxious society and a pretty litigious society, so OBGYNs get sued for so many different things. But I saw Swiss women certainly giving their newborns, or not quite newborns, but young babies, chocolate and cheese. Germans and Italians, as you said, certainly were drinking wine during their pregnancy and having cheese, all kinds, any kind they could. I was in Bangladesh during this time, and all of the different women that I knew from all over the world had all kinds of things that they ate or drank and had perfectly healthy babies. By the way, I was in my 30s during this time, and I just think that we have to remember that what you said is so true, moderation. You know, you don't want to give your child fetal alcohol syndrome, but you can certainly have a drink every now and then.
Marianne, thank you very much. I mean, some things are culturally constructed. Some things are science, and our guest is looking at the science as much as possible. But on a cultural difference, Emily, one of the things that happens in the United States, maybe more than elsewhere, is that if a pregnant woman is eating sushi or drinking a glass of wine in public, she's no doubt being judged. So for the non-pregnant crowd, your book maybe is for them too, like don't judge pregnant women because they're doing what may not be harming their kid?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, the rule don't be judgy of people is a good one. But I do, you know, I would certainly encourage non-pregnant people to purchase and read my book. I think that there is this feeling often when you're pregnant that people are kind of watching you and saying in line for Starbucks always that, you know, I hope that that's decaf. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of a feeling that somehow because somebody is pregnant, it's like okay to comment on what they're doing. You, of course, see this once you have the kid as well. People have a lot of thoughts on your parenting. And I think that that's something that many of us find irritating.
Emily in Parsippany. You're on WNYC with Emily in Chicago.
Hi. When I was 5 months pregnant, I had to have a root canal and was prescribed super high-powered painkillers that I couldn't get off my couch. I was so knocked out, and I only took one pill because they made me feel so terrible. And I'm wondering if the pharmaceutical industry has an interest in doing the research to say that that was fine. My kid was born perfectly healthy and wonderful, but the wine industry isn't doing the same kind of funding.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think drugs, you know, drugs in pregnancy are very hard to learn about. So, you know, when I was trying to go through kind of risks of different, you know, painkillers or antibiotics, because appropriately it's very difficult to experiment on pregnant women, we have very little data about the safety of a lot of these drugs. So there are a few that we know are really dangerous. And, you know, a few that we know are quite safe, and then many things which we're just not quite sure. And I sort of share your view that there's obviously a very clear incentive by somebody to say that these are safe, although the truth is we often don't really know.
Emily in Parsippany, thank you. But it seems to me that what you've found throughout the book is that the studies often don't differentiate between correlation and causation. And therefore, you dismiss a lot of the studies. But since you're not a scientist running your own experiments, how can you be sure that certain correlations are not causation? Why not better safe than sorry if you find that, you know, certain things that you eat or you do are associated with damage to the fetus, even if you can't prove scientifically causation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is true that correlation and causation are a big issue here. So in the case of something like alcohol, that is actually, you know, that is an issue that comes up for sure. And I think one of the things that you see in the data is actually the children of women who drink occasionally actually perform quite a bit better in some dimensions than the children of women who abstain. And so in a lot of those cases, you want to think about not only is there correlation and causation, but what is the direction of the bias? So if I see that two cups of coffee, that 200 milligrams of coffee a day is okay, even though I know that the bias is going to lead me to condemned coffee too quickly, then I should be more confident about that result because in some sense it's giving me an upper bound on how dangerous coffee is. And so that's the nuance of doing this that I think, you know, that's what I'm trained in, but that was a lot of what was very difficult about evaluating a lot of this evidence. And I try to make it clear to women exactly, you know, why did I make the choice that I did, and what are some of the things that you might want to think about? Maybe your preferences are different from mine.
Melissa in Greenwich, you're on WNYC with Emily Oster. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I'm 7 months pregnant, and I grew up in a physician's household. And so there's a lot of juxtaposing views going on that I'm getting from my pediatrician and my gynecologist versus the flu shot. And I just wanted to know what you recommend because I'm debating what to do.
Did you look at flu shots, Emily?
I did not look at flu shots. And I think in the spirit of, like, not overstepping what one knows, I did not do research on flu shots, and so I am not going to feel up to commenting.
Sorry, we can't help you with that one, Melissa, and probably a lot of other people asking the same question. Nancy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, number one, I'm a midwife, and I'm, as always, a bit turned off by the idea that OBGYNs are thought of as the ultimate authority. Women in this country are cared for by midwives. They're cared for lovingly and instructively without the patriarchal attitude of this is what you have to do or this is what you cannot do. So I would say I've never seen a pregnant woman for an appointment for less than half an hour. I've always done my counseling in terms of risk and benefit analysis, and I will never say to anyone something is 100% safe or 100% bad for you, ever. Because I don't think it's true.
Do you think, Nancy, that pregnant women aren't looking to you as an expert for some answers, though, and that some trust with your doctors or your midwives is something that ultimately provides a lot of peace of mind?
I think they do want answers, and I think some women are offended by being challenged to actually do their own research. I will often have women be very thankful to me for this risk-benefit analysis approach, and other women who are like, I don't want to do anything on my own. Just give me a pill.
Give me an example. Can you give me a quick example of how you communicate a risk-benefit analysis?
Well, somebody, for example, might be on an antidepressant before pregnancy, and they find out they're pregnant, and they're like, do I stay on it? What's going to happen to my kid? And we have to talk about what are the risks of taking the medicine versus what are the risks to your functioning level if you don't take the medicine. What's the lowest dose you can possibly take that will have the best effect for you? We talk about it as a composite life problem rather than, sure, it's safe, take it, go ahead. I'll never have an absolute answer for anybody because I don't believe that anything you put in your mouth, even prenatal vitamins, are 100% risk-free.
Emily, you liking this or not liking this?
Yeah, I'm loving this. I'm going to like get her phone number off the air in case I ever move to New York and have another kid.
you want her
yeah,
to deliver
I mean, I think this is exactly this idea of kind of communicating the risks and benefits and like taking time to go through this is exactly, you know, is kind of exactly what I'm advocating people do. And I think, you know, if you have a midwife or a doctor who's going to, you know, do that with you, I think that that's totally awesome. I think I was very interested in this thing she just said about, like, sometimes women don't want this. And I have seen some of this, you know, occasionally the reaction to the book is like, well, I don't want to figure this out for myself. You know, I just want someone to tell me what to do. And I think that actually that can be something that's hard for a provider, a midwife or a doctor to address, because in some sense, even if you do want to give people, look, this is a nuanced choice, I can't really tell you what to do. And if your patient is saying, oh, just tell me what to do, then I think that's a real challenge.
And in our last minute, and Nancy, thank you so much for weighing in, let's touch on the last stage of pregnancy, which is labor and delivery. You do deal with this in the book, epidurals, Pitocin, episiotomies. If we assume for the moment that Pitocin and episiotomies are things that people get only if they really have to, how about the epidural? The natural childbirth philosophy might say, don't do it for most people.
Yeah, so I had I felt like there were really two camps here. There were people who were like, if you get the epidural, it's terrible, and people who said, you know, there's no downsides. And I think what you learn by going through the data here is, you know, on the whole, the epidural is very safe and it provides a very, very effective form of pain relief. It does have some downsides. It makes labor, the process of labor, a little more complicated. It slightly lengthens the pushing time in labor. It increases the chance of using forceps or a vacuum extractor. And so there are sort of some small risks. And I think that different women will look at this and decide differently. So I did not have an epidural, but, you know, my closest friend did have one, and, you know, she told me afterwards, like, you're a crazy weirdo, like, that was a terrible choice, but I thought it was a good choice. So I think in the end, we were both happy, and you know, seeing the same data, we didn't come to the same choice, but that's really what choice is all about.
Well, what happens when an economist who's married to an economist and is the daughter of two economists gets pregnant? She gets obsessed with the statistics and winds up writing the book, Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know. We thank University of Chicago economist Emily Oster for all this conversation. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, how video games influence recruitment, training, and war itself in the military. And then Ruben Santiago Hudson, Stephen McKinley Henderson, and Arthur Yorinks on producing August Wilson's 10-play American Century Cycle for radio. Stay with us.